sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A flash crash and a stunning reversal. Oil up 16% for the week. News from Jackson Hole and our guest, Cullen Roche from Orkham Financial Group. All this and much more on episode number 427 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the crazy end of a wacky week. Andrew Horowitz here, your host here for the Disciplined Investor Podcast and the writer of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can also find me on DH Unplugged, a podcast I do every week with John C. Dvorak. That comes out on Tuesday, Wednesdays of every week. Pre-recorded actually Tuesday evening. So if you want to stay up late, well, you can get it. And it comes out about 11 o'clock at night on Eastern Time on Tuesdays. All right. So, wow. That was some week, wasn't it? Did you have fun or panic out or what happened? There was I would guess the best way to describe it is a flash crash on Monday where futures were locked down for the first, 15 minutes prior to the open at 9:30 in the morning. And we had quite the incredible amount of stocks that were getting bid just, 15, 20% down after the open. It's like something happened on the open, even though we saw about 1,000 points down on the Dow and the S&P was just getting crushed and the NASDAQ was getting slammed. But it opened up, things got kind of stabilized, and then all of a sudden, bids got dropped. It's like sell stops got cascaded, and we saw just a host of real problems. I mean, J.P. Morgan down 20%, Kroger was down 25% at one point. So there was all sorts of problems with the actual open, and then things seemed to get themselves settled out a little bit, stabilize. And while there was a point during the day that there was a major rip to the upside and a lot of credit goes to the letter from Tim Cook at Apple about this. Well, things are looking better in China and not such a problem. And actually, we have more activations of our iPhones and selling better than ever. And anyway, things turned around pretty strongly. Bottom line, though, is that we, questioned whether or not that was going to last. And markets obviously turned around pretty strongly during the day, back down, finished on the lows. In fact, on Tuesday, finished on the lows. Wednesday, finally started to turn around, kind of came in and then ramped higher throughout the day, up 600 points. By the end of the week, the amazing thing was that the Dow actually was up. The S&P was up. The NASDAQ was up by the end of the week. Now, some of the credit of that was given to the fact that China finally started to put money to work, the government, that is, put money to work in their markets, raising the Shanghai index on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And it didn't really make up for all the losses during the week, but the good news was that there was a turnaround there. What really was, I think, most interesting about it all was that we had this reversal off of these bottoms, and there was some support there, and there was some question as to why this was all going on, just panic over maybe China, panic over what was going on in Europe, just a follow through, maybe it was something to do with currencies. Maybe the carry trade was being unwound and some of that was in stocks and it had to be unwound as well. So there's all these things that were converging at once and boom, markets just really were in turmoil. So we did see this major move. We did see that there was some good economics in the United States that would, of course, continue to sustain the belief that we will have a rate increase in September. A lot of talk about maybe QE4 coming out. Ray Dalio talked about that. We'll maybe get to that a little bit later. But generally speaking, nothing's different in the U.S. Earnings are a little bit softer than anticipated. Outlook and guidance a little bit softer. Revenues just coming in right at levels that they had been over the last couple of quarters, maybe a little bit lower. oil prices moving down, commodities getting hit, and then all of a sudden this magical turnaround Thursday and Friday for oil. 16% move higher into the $45 territory. It dipped down below 40, 39s and change, and then all of a sudden ripped higher. Just ripped on Thursday and Friday. What were the reasons? I have no idea. I looked for reasons. I tried to look at, well, maybe some currency. No, not currency. Maybe it's the idea that possibly GDP came in at 3.7% versus the second reading or the initial readings of 2.6. So the economy in the U.S. is doing better. We know that initial claims have been doing better and moving lower. Some of the lowest we've seen in years. We see that manufacturing is holding up, services holding up. Consumer confidence came in on Tuesday pretty strong. As a matter of fact, unusually strong. Housing was looking okay. Now, Friday, fast forward, we did see GDP better. Consumer confidence of the University of Michigan did flop a bit, did come in under expectations. But still, overall, things are still okay. No problems really being seen, no holes, nothing really that is spurring the concern. Except for a few economists out there, just a very few that, hey, you know what? A recession is around the corner. But generally speaking, I don't see the numbers that really support that thesis. So when we look at the U.S. compared to the rest of the world, clearly at this point right now, it's a bit of an oasis. It's a bit of a place where you can't say that, well, a lot of the concern over China and Europe and some of the commodity-driven countries is really affecting us here. In fact, you could probably say that a lot of players are doing their best to push money over to the U.S. as a safe haven investment, whether it be the bonds, whether it be the stocks, currencies, etc. Underlying all of it, we have been talking about at great length and detail right here about some of the potential of the countries around the world, how it may affect the U.S. moving forward. But right now, just in the moment, there really isn't a problem. Now, maybe, let's kind of throw this out there. Maybe what's happening is that as the stock market is a discounting mechanism of future activity and future potential economic uncertainty, that maybe what's happening is some of that fear is getting into markets over here. On the other hand, how do you explain that enormous rise, that 1,000-point rise on 2 days from the Dow Jones? Is it simply just buy the dip? Let's get that V going. Or was it maybe outside, maybe sovereign wealth funds or countries or other people just starting to say, hey, you know what? Maybe companies doing their buybacks. I don't know. But what was that really spurred it to the fact that we took this major downward move, whereas we had all markets in quote unquote 10% correction territory and it turned around. Something changed on Wednesday and Thursday. Something dramatic really happened there. Now, it could have been as simple as end-of-month window dressing, end-of-month painting the tape. We've talked about this so many different times that end-of-month usually this happens. Last couple of days of the month, you know, Monday is coming in as the last day of August, and maybe there are a lot of players out there that are looking to bring their portfolio values up, and you know what? At these low levels, what the heck? Might as well put some money to work. That's possible. So all these things, we'll see how they play out over the next month, especially into September FOMC meeting, where we're going to have a spirited debate, if nothing else, about whether or not there's going to be an initial rate hike and a change to the Fed's monetary policy, even in the slightest amount, where they will take some money off the table. The fact is that it's gotten really ridiculous. Let's kind of really put our cards on the table and let's talk. How ridiculous has it become that almost every conversation on CNBC and other different media outlets has been all about the Fed? And we're talking about a 25 basis point move here in an economy that has been doing okay with an unemployment rate of 5.3%, with GDP now at 3.7, supposedly. It seems a little bit ludicrous that this fascination has been going on. It's almost gotten to a point of ridiculousness with the handicapping. If you listen to Steve Leisman, all he does, well, now there's a 50% chance. Now there's a 42.5% chance. Now there's a 63.125% chance. Ridiculous how they are handicapping this. You got to wonder, what are they going to do after? It's kind of like the Weather Channel. Like if there's no hurricane, I don't know about you. I'm in Florida and we had this potential for a hurricane coming over the last number of days. So what do? You watch the Weather Channel, go to weatherunderground.com. I'm looking around trying to track what's going on. I'm watching what's happening. And of course, that helps their ratings. A lot of people are visiting the Weather Channel these days as the weather changes and gets dramatic. Whether you live in the north during the winter, you're in the tornado section, you want to find out what's going on, whether you're in the south and there's hurricanes. During those times where things are unsettling, where there's some concern and questions, you tune in. Maybe what's happening is that this is a way for them just to get ratings. And you got to wonder what happens to the Weather Channel's ratings and the amount of visits they get and viewership when there is no hurricane, when there is no active storms, where there is no weather that is concerning anybody around the world. I bet you the same thing is going on with these business channels. When there is no initial move by the Fed, who's going to listen anymore? So they're milking it for everything they can these days. And that's what it seems like to me. After that, what is Steve Leeson going to talk about? It's not going to be as exciting to talk about the next rate hike. Or the next, it's just not going to be as exciting as the initial move off of a systematically very, very accommodative policy that has been going on. This next move is a big change. It's a very big change compared to where we are these days, right? Where we've been in for the last, 8 years? 8 years? Is it 8 years now? Let me think about this. Seven to eight years, we've been in a very accommodative policy by the Fed, getting more accommodative technically as we go along, and now all of a sudden things are going to change. So maybe that's where they're getting their ratings. Anyway, we did see that from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, a variety of Fed speakers talked about this, still the potential for a Fed change of move in September. Didn't seem like there was any of this concern about China or markets really disturbing Stanley Fischer in his speeches, but we'll have to see how that plays out. Anyway, I want to get to our guest because I know he has a lot to talk about. So let's kind of stop right there and we'll pick it up. And our guest today is Cullen Roche. He is the founder of Orcom Financial Group. He writes as the Pragmatic Capitalist at www.pragcap.com. We'll put that information, of course, on the show notes. And he manages money. So we're going to get hopefully some good insight onto what went on this week. Cullen, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Thanks
for having me.
Yeah, fun stuff happening in the markets, huh?
I know. It's been super boring, huh? I'm trying to figure out something more entertaining to do for a living.
No, I tell you something. It has been kind of boring up until, 6 weeks ago. Kind of things were just floating and bubbling up.
Almost for years, actually.
Yeah,
The market was kind of starting to remind me of that 2005, 2006 environment a little bit, where things, I don't know if you remember that period, but it was just a really sort of boring kind of moderate economic expansion where things were just sort of bleeding up slowly, but it sort of seemed like nothing could go wrong. And then
kaboom,
you know, boom.
Calm before the storm, maybe, huh?
Yeah.
So I have a lot of things to talk to you about. You have some writings that you've sent and other things that I've read and things that you've written, of course. Great stuff. I don't know where to start. I guess we could start with China. I mean, China is obviously front and center of everybody's minds. It's been obviously something for years that I've said you can't trust the data. But the fact is you have nothing else to go on, so you might as well play along.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden there's an epiphany. Everybody's like, oh, China's slowing down. China's numbers are not looking so good. And I'm thinking, well, I guess we got to believe those now, I suppose. But you talked about in a recent article about the black box of China's economics and kind of the opening of it. Maybe it's Pandora's box, who knows. But kind of like we're all seeing inside of it now, more exposed, more laid bare. Kind of, can you go through a little bit about some of these concepts?
Yeah, so China's a really opaque sort of economy. You know, they're obviously largely state-owned, and so a lot of the data is really massaged and managed methodically. And what we've seen over the course of the last 4 years is a fairly slow and steady slowdown in the overall data. I mean, even the headline GDP figures that come out of the state have slowed from 10-11% down to now 7% or so. And you can look at other data within China. Like I follow rail traffic closely around the globe, and the rail traffic data in China actually shows something that is potentially even worse than that. Could be consistent with, who knows, even maybe a contraction that's going on in China, but a really slow, steady sort of slowdown. And what's really strange to me is that China's been slowing down now for 4 or 5 years, and we've seen this kind of slow bleed in markets like the commodity markets and whatnot. And this just hasn't had a huge impact on really anything in the domestic U.S. economy at all. So it's very strange to me that this suddenly became such a big issue, because the slowdown in China seems to have almost been inversely correlated to U.S. economic performance, and especially the S&P 500, for 4 or 5 years now. But all of a sudden, we just sort of had this rush to judgment and panic, I think largely due to what was going on in the Chinese stock market, which, again, the Shanghai composite over there is sort of an insignificant global economic indicator, because it's really owned by a fairly small portion of mainland Chinese investors. It makes up a very small portion of domestic net worth within China itself. And really only, I mean, within the US, China only contributes about 5% to S&P 500 revenues. So this whole thing, I probably sound like I'm downplaying it more than I should be, but to me, the degree of panic this week that we saw seemed particularly irrational, given how interconnected China really is to what's going on, especially within the USA. So,
we have a much more connected and a much more reliant economy on China in Europe because of the proximity, not to mention the fact that the rest of the nations around China that have they're talking, you know, close to 1.5 billion people. And if they're slowing down on their consumption, you know, somehow. And if, in fact, I think maybe it was the missteps of the central banks, maybe it was the devaluation, which came out of left field. Which then maybe possibly, just I'm just throwing this out, threw a lot of other currencies into a tailspin, and there was some other devaluations. And
yeah, well,
that was the big issue, right?
That was the thing that really kind of tripped everything. It seemed like once they started to shift the currency position there, I can't remember when that was. That was 2 weeks ago or so. But they when they tripped that, that kind of really changed the sentiment, and people seemed to almost start pricing in a permanent change in what was going to be, I guess, the future of Forex positions here. And what we've had, I think a lot of this has been sort of exacerbated by the Federal Reserve, in large part because they've been so adamant about raising interest rates in September and really trying to forecast that you kind of got almost a confluence of multiple negative events, where the Chinese all of a sudden were trying to, it looked like, devalue to some degree. The USA, it looked like, was on the verge of raising interest rates. And that just set up a really nasty sort of environment for the commodity markets and a lot of emerging market currencies, where the USA was just on the exact opposite side of all of this. And being the reserve currency in the global economy, it just was kind of a confluence of the worst type of positioning that you could possibly have at that particular time. And I think a lot of clarity has come out since then. The Fed, I think, has backtracked to some degree on raising interest rates. And China has shown that they're not going to just implement a one-way devaluation in the yuan. So yeah. I think cooler heads are kind of starting to prevail to some degree about all of this.
But you have to add in, I think, a little bit to this whole equation, the concern about the global headwinds of the fact that, you know, Europe, okay, they could do all this quantitative easing all they want, but the fact is that their economies are still questionable. Greece, fortunately, I haven't even heard about in 2 weeks. It's kind of a relief. You know, now it's changed over to China. But on top of this, it's interesting that many firms, the latest being Walmart, are really looking at a guidance that has been lowered dramatically. We're seeing that revenues are slowing down here in the U.S. So I think that has to be put into the equation, because, you know, earnings are really the essential underpinning of market valuation. right? Or a stocks valuation, which goes into a market. And I think that when you look at what's gone on, you have a lot of share buybacks, not to, you know, to belabor that point, which I've constantly been hitting on, is something that's very concerning to me. It's a good thing, but when it ends, it's going to be a problem because you have all of a sudden a lack of liquidity. Look what happened on Monday. So Monday, you know, you don't get necessarily share buybacks on the open. You know, throughout the day, maybe towards the end of the day, you get these share buybacks that go on. And a lot of the share buy, you got a tremendous amount of money that's going into with companies buying back their shares. Well, you had all of a sudden this kind of market meltdown on Monday morning where the futures got locked down and closed and halted for however many minutes, 15 minutes at 9 o'clock in the morning before the market opened. And then all of a sudden the market opens, a couple of minutes go by, and all of a sudden the bottom drops out on individual names. I mean, they could be large names, small names. I mean, you're talking about, you know, 15, 20%. I think JP Morgan was down 20% on a few ticks, right? ETFs, you mentioned to me earlier, ETFs. You saw ETFs
down 25, 50%. I saw it. Crazy.
That's unbelievable. Why? Well, you don't have the underpinnings of companies buying, and you had a cascade of bids getting taken down as well as stops being hit. But the and obviously it's going to be a mini flash crash is what we had. Let's kind of
that. Another thing that I've been hearing a lot of this week is I have a good friend who works at an HFT firm, a high frequency trading firm, and he mentioned to me this week that what he was seeing looked a lot like momentum trading algorithms sort of just almost creating their own positive feedback loop almost, where they were basically chasing each other to the point where the algorithm speeds up so much that it literally breaks the algorithm. And when it breaks, you don't have any momentum, basically. It just spirals out of control into a black hole, basically. And so I'm beginning to wonder, you know, it was really interesting for me watching it real time because I was sitting there, and as a human and someone who has traded through markets like this before, I knew that it was broken. I could see visually that things were not trading at values that they should have been trading at. And it makes me wonder what degree we've sort of created this robotic sort of marketplace where maybe a little more human intervention is probably not such a bad thing, because the humans will look at things like this and recognize something in real time that a robot just won't recognize. And
yeah, that's at least at this point, until AI comes into the market, then what's the point of any of this, right? But the thing is, and you know what? Tell me about this, right? So you saw all this happening. You're a human. You couldn't react fast enough for the rip to the other side. I mean, maybe on a few cases you got lucky. You hit it right at the right time. But the amount of time it took to consume what was going on and the potential for where were the stocks that were getting hit as hard and to actually go and click buttons, to actually click a button to buy at that price, by the time you hit that button, the price is probably a buck in the other direction.
Yeah. Well, I wonder the degree to which, you know, maybe the reduction in human market making has had a big impact on a lot of stuff.
Tremendous.
Because, you know, if you had people from Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and a lot of the big banks sitting there with a huge buy-sell book waiting for things like, I mean, these guys used to relish in these sorts of environments because they see something like Monday morning happen and they say to themselves, I mean, this is why they exist. This is literally why they're there.
Party.
Exactly. I mean, and so I wonder, you know, the robots, I don't know, as great as a lot of this technology is, I'm beginning to wonder, I mean, even with just, not even on the trading side, but just with the technological advances that we've seen in terms of giving people just access to 24/7 news and the ability to trade and on an intraday basis and whatnot, I wonder how much of this is really good for us and how much of this is just making us that much worse at trading
I'll share this with you. I think that it's interesting that many of the market makers of yesterday, and I mean yesterday, I mean yesteryear, that I know are no longer in business. And when they initially switched over to be day traders or prop traders, they were making money. But they can't do that anymore. I know some of the best traders in the business that have difficulty in these market conditions. Now, I'm not talking about Monday. I'm talking about just normal daily market conditions. that have a significantly difficult time in actually, making things happen for themselves on a consistent basis, because there is this process where computers are looking to outwit the other side.
Yeah, it's been a huge shift in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, I remember, so I used to run a partnership where I would trade in really illiquid markets at weird times. I mean, we're talking like literally the middle of the night and right when markets that nobody trades would open. And I recall back then as the high frequency trading thing sort of started to pick up, I started to notice some of the front running that was happening in positions that I would be the only buyer in a market sometimes where I would place a bid and instantaneously a bid would pop up in front of mine. I mean, and that's the sort of thing that you see when you've done this for years and years and you start seeing this happening. I mean, it's just a sign that the markets have completely changed in terms of how they sort of operate on a daily basis.
Right. So now let's switch over to something else that you've talked about, because it's interesting. I think there's a good segue into this next topic, which is the whole, I'm going to let you explain it, but your take on traditional asset allocation and traditional modern portfolio theory that has the opposite side of our discussion. We're talking about trading, intraday trading or trading. This is kind of the opposite side, the more of the buy and the hold, the asset allocation. You know, give me your take on the whole idea of MPT.
Well, so I approach this from a very operational perspective. I think most of the people who probably know a lot of my work know about my work on the monetary system and to sort of understanding the operational realities of what makes the financial system tick. And coming at things from, I mean, although I'm a portfolio manager, I come at a lot of this from an economics perspective because I sort of traverse both fields there. And I'm a real stickler about the idea that most people who allocate financial assets into the financial markets are literal savers. They are taking their savings and they are allocating in some prudent manner that should be really more consistent with the idea of savings rather than investing. And from a very specific perspective or economically correct perspective, investing is spending for future production. Okay, so when an entrepreneur goes out and raises funding or something like that, what they're doing when they actually spend the cash that they raise is technically investment. They're spending for future production and they're hiring employees or they're building a factory that will ultimately make their company more valuable and make goods and services that make society better and increases the standards of living for everybody. That's true investment. What the rest of us do when we buy financial assets on a secondary market, for instance, like the New York Stock Exchange, is literally an exchange of different types of savings instruments that have already been issued for the purpose of investment. So I like to prefer to call portfolios savings portfolios, because what most of us are doing is much more akin to an allocation of savings rather than investing, which the reason I think that the concept of investing is somewhat dangerous is because I think it can be sold to people as something that is sort of sexy and high return. And we always hear about trying to beat the market and do things that are sort of replicating a Warren Buffett type approach or a hedge fund type approach and something real fancy. And most people, they don't actually need their savings to do anything like that. It would be great if they could maximize their returns. But what I find is that the vast majority of people have actually much more aversion to permanent loss risk than they do to just making big gains in the market. And that sort of mentality, if you take that sort of savings portfolio mentality, you arrive generally at portfolios that deviate very much from what you would derive using a modern portfolio theory type of portfolio, because I think the tendency with modern portfolio theory is to almost always arrive at a very stock-heavy allocation. I mean, generally, someone who's using MPT will say something like, well, stocks on average generate 8 to 10% returns per year. And if you've got a decent time horizon, we know that the rolling returns of stocks on a 10 or 20 year basis are pretty much always positive. And so that tends to lead to the conclusion that we should almost always be in a stock-heavy portfolio. And unfortunately, what a lot of people don't realize is that even a marginally overweight stock portfolio, like a 60-40 portfolio, for instance, that portfolio exposes you to a huge amount of permanent loss risk inside of a year like 2008 or 2009, where even that portfolio falls 35-40%. And so I don't think people often understand that even a fairly balanced portfolio is actually substantially underweight protection against permanent loss at times. And I think that's the biggest flaw in the way that a lot of people build portfolios, is that they end up reaching for return and sacrificing stability. And what unfortunately happens a lot of the times, and times when the markets start to get really jittery and uncertain, and you start to see these big declines, which are inevitable in any portfolio that is stock heavy, is that people react the wrong way. They find out what their risk tolerance is after the market goes through a big decline. Well, it's the worst time to figure out what your risk tolerance is.
I can lose money?
What? Yeah, exactly.
No, but let me just take the other side of this discussion for 1 second. True monoportfolio theory, which I have practiced and studied quite an extreme amount, actually, back in the 90s in particular, when it was kind of all the rage. But I spent a lot of time discussing this and researching this, writing about this, even spending some time with William Sharpe, spending time with Brinson Biebauer Hood guys, those kind of, you know, the guys that kind of came up with this whole thing and made it popular, is that you look to not only create a portfolio that has a high degree of opportunity, let's just put that aside, but more so you're looking for a portfolio that has differing assets underlying the portfolio that can withstand various conditions if, in fact, markets don't do well. So, for example, if you want to, you know, somebody says, oh, let's do some asset allocation. We're going to put 20% in large caps. We're going to put 30% in small caps. We're going to buy 15% in European, and we're going to buy 20% in Asian, and we're going to put, I don't know what my addition is here, but 10% in commodities and 15% in bonds, whatever that comes out to be. The problem is the correlation between almost every asset class I just mentioned, aside from maybe bonds, maybe commodities, is pretty much one-on-one these days. Mm-hmm. And that creates very little downside protection. Now, unfortunately, the correlation between all of this, because of the not only the connectiveness of the world, but also due to the fact that we have information 24/7, where we didn't have it before, where you could trade on different markets at any given time, has pretty much blown up the old MPT concept. You know, because right now you'd be like, okay, well, commodities are a decent diversifier against inflation. Maybe you want a little bit of gold, you know, within that area too. You want to have U.S. stock. Well, meanwhile, you know, you look at the markets. When the markets come up, bonds are being bought. What the hell is that all about? Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense. When markets come down, they're selling bonds too. Not all the time, but many times. That's not normal. And the problem is, if you want to take this into one big, okay, what's the reason? It's because all of the distortions that the Fed and the central banks around the world have created by pushing money into the system has created asset inflation across almost every single asset class and correlating them to a point that because there is all this liquidity, excess money, low interest rates, that you could just buy anything for such a low cost. What the hell? Do you agree with any of this?
Well, they've created, so QE is something I've talked about a lot. What they've created through quantitative easing is this really the portfolio rebalancing effect. And what this has done is, basically what they've done is they've taken a lot of interest-bearing financial assets out of the financial system. And what this does is, from a very basic supply-demand perspective, you inject a lot of cash into the system. And those people who are now holding cash, well, actually the aggregate income of the private sector has been reduced because you've now reduced the income from all these interest-bearing instruments that people used to own. And that's now going to the Fed, which is going to the Treasury, which is going to pay down basically the deficit. And so what's going on is you have this huge portfolio rebalancing effect. And like you said, this has created a huge amount of demand for virtually any type of even high risk interest bearing type of instrument. And so, you know, what sort of scares me about things like QE is that I think not only does it have this very powerful rebalancing effect in terms of how people's portfolios are rebalanced, but it has a very powerful psychological impact on people. And central banks, I think, sometimes don't understand how much of an impact the psychological impact really influences the overall financial markets. And, you know, trying to manage the economy through these sorts of policies is a very imprecise and sometimes a really dangerous sort of precedent to set, because it makes people somewhat reliant on what they're doing ultimately, because they're such a massive price setter inside of the economy and such a massive asset influencer inside of the economy that we almost become dependent on their policy to some degree, which is a really frightening sort of precedent for them to set.
Yeah, but you can't get away from it, unfortunately. Fact is, you know, we can cry about this all we want, and we could talk about all the negative with it. A lot of people are very happy about it. A lot of people think, hey, this is the best thing ever.
Well, it's become, so they're in a real bind, because what's happened is the Fed, with zero interest rates and a fairly weak economy, they've really been, I mean, cornered by what their policy options are to some degree, because they obviously can't cut interest rates. I mean, if the U.S. economy were to go into a recession, only policy tool they really have is QE. I mean, that has become the de facto policy tool now for the Fed to kind of implement.
And by the way, Ray Dalio, with the head and brilliant fellow, the head of the largest hedge fund in the world, has this week said that the potential, as a matter of fact, he's even predicting that in the September meeting, they may announce a new round of QE. Is that really even in the cards?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. That's something that I'm starting to hear a lot more about that.
Well, but because the markets come down and the players that need to get the markets back up have to spread rumor about something to gain, you know, sustainability. I can't even imagine the next round of QE, how that would actually boost stock prices any further, because interest rates are so low. We saw just this week, we saw the 10-year back at 2%. I mean, where are we going to push it down to 1.5?
Right.
I mean, where do we go with this?
I mean, gosh, I'd be shocked if they announced a new round of QE just from a few market jitters like this. But who knows? I mean, they seem to have responded to, if you remember 2011, they kind of responded with something similar.
The market was slowing down. We didn't have the unemployment rate that we have now. And at the same time, they weren't talking out of both sides of their orifices about the potential for a raise in interest rates.
Yeah.
This would be actually, I think, I don't know what the outcome, let's call it 3 months down the road. I think it would freak out markets if they spun on this.
So here's the thing I've been hearing from some corners of the markets is that what they could do at some point is not only raise interest rates, but also announce a coinciding QE4 program, which would, you know, it's kind of hard to digest, but it would get the first rate hike out of the way, at least get them off of zero. But it would also, to some degree, support longer treasury markets or reduce long-term interest rates to some degree by taking more supply out of the market. But yeah, I don't know how realistic that is.
How much more do you need interest rates to, well, interest rates wouldn't go down. It would kind of almost be a neutral move, right? And don't forget, they're still buying about, I think, $15 to $20 billion worth of bonds every single month just because of the interest that and maturities that are coming through the QE program they already have for the $4 trillion worth of bonds they have on hand at the that they own already.
Uh-huh.
So they're still buying $20 billion a month. So, I mean, that's QE right there. I mean, can you imagine if we announced there's no QE. Hey, we're going to start buying $15 to $20 billion of bonds per month. Everybody be like, hey, that's QE. You know, that's good. Now, raising interest rates by 0.25%. Let's say they go to, now we're at the 0 to 0.25, which I don't know what the range means exactly. I can't ever figure this out. But let's just say it's somewhere in the middle. It's 12.5, 0.125. Maybe they raise it to, let's just say, I mean, maybe they'll do some oddball number, usually use quarter points, 0.375, 0.5. How much can that constrain an economy by moving interest rates up that small of amount. We've seen that kind of move on bonds recently from top to bottom on the 30 years, for example, which then kicks off money valuations for mortgages and things of that nature. I mean, I think actually I can go so far as saying, and I've said this many times, and tell me what you think about this, that actually them raising interest rates could kickstart the economy, get people off their duff thinking, hey, you know what? Rates are going to go lower. I'll wait to do this. I'll wait to borrow the money to start my business. I'll wait to borrow the money to buy that new piece of equipment. You know what? I better do it because rates are going to go up in the future. And what will happen is they'll actually rush in to do things.
Yeah. No, I think you could be right. It's the really, I actually wrote about that, I think late last year, early this year, that the rationale for a rate hike really makes, I think, a lot more sense than most people are implying right now. I think we sort of have this very basic theoretical construct in a lot of economic circles about how interest rates actually impact the economy. Basically, you know, you cut interest rates and that boosts demand for debt. And if you increase interest rates, that reduces demand for debt. But it's interesting. I think the one thing that we've sort of learned from the last 7 years is that maybe interest rates aren't this all-powerful mechanism for creating demand for debt and whatnot, and that maybe the interest rate mechanism in which it impacts the broader economy is maybe a little bit different. And I think that you're right. I think that there's the potential here that going forward, you could see an interest rate increase actually spark some economic growth, because not only are you implementing the sort of behavioral response that you mentioned, but you're also increasing people's interest income, which will naturally, I mean, like I mentioned before, with what they're doing with QE, they're reducing interest income through QE in the aggregate. So if the Fed were to actually set the floor on short-term interest rates at a higher rate, it would actually boost a lot of short-term interest income from a lot of these entities that ultimately pay into, you know, a lot of savings accounts and whatnot. And I think that would spark, it would spark a little bit of a redistribution from basically from corporations into more of, you know, the actual private sector that goes out and and buys goods and services and whatnot. So yeah, I think an interest rate increase could potentially be somewhat expansionary.
So let me get back to the whole discussion of monoportfolio theory for a moment. And for the, I think that if I could maybe speak and summarize what you're saying a little bit, is it's for the most part maybe being used incorrectly. Could I say that?
Yeah, well, I think so much of economic theory is based around the idea of what's called the natural rate theory, which is this idea that there is one price in the economy. And if the Fed can establish that one price in the economy, then they can drive employment to full employment and they can, you know, create this big economic boom. And it's a very sort of theoretical concept, and nobody really knows if it actually exists, or certainly nobody knows what that interest rate is at any given time. But all or a lot of economic theory is based around this whole concept of the natural rate. And I just don't know if it, maybe there is a natural rate, but even if there is, in my mind, there's probably millions and millions of different natural rates depending on which market you're talking about. And, you know, this isn't all just one big marketplace. The economy is really made up of millions and millions of little different marketplaces and different assets and different, you know, markets that depend on different price mechanisms, basically.
So let me just go one step further. So if, in fact, modern portfolio theory in its rawest sense is kind of used a little bit wrong in terms of the theory that, okay, it's all backward looking and there is a heavy influence of the performance of equities over time that have been utilized to say, hey, you know what? Don't worry about the ups and downs. It's a longer term, you know, this whole thing that you're talking about, right? And possibly with the fact that there is an asset allocation that may be, as I mentioned, linked too closely to each other so that you're not getting that downside, you must be, at least I'm thinking this, a little bit skeptical about these robo-advising portfolios.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're really the worst culprit of implementing modern portfolio theory.
I thought I would hit that nail on the head.
It's a little, it frightens me sometimes.
It scares the crap out of me. I mean, especially the way they do this. By the way, for those of you that don't know, you basically go into one of these places. It's a variety of different sources out there that are saying, hey, here's the deal. answer 5 or 6 questions. You know, if your market went down by 30%, would you lose sleep at night? And what's your goal for this? What do you think you are, an aggressive investor or not? 5 or 6 very lame questions that everybody gets. And then they say, well, you know what? With those answers, you are moderate portfolio 3.
Yep.
And that portfolio, this is what we're going to do. We're going to invest this for you. And we're going to utilize all these ETFs. And what we're going to do is an amazing thing. We are going to, on a regular basis, rebalance the portfolio from the losers to the winners, from the winners to the losers. So if you made 10% on something, let's say over 3 months, they'll scrape off some of the profits, throw it into the areas that are maybe underperforming. And this way, you can obviously buy at the lows and sell at the highs. And look what could be long-term, because we see historical reference from this. And pretty much that's the whole program.
Yeah, no, I mean, you just hit the nail on the head. I think that one thing that's great is that they're providing really access to low fee portfolio management in a way that is much more accessible than anything that really previously existed. But I think that we've almost reached a point where people are willing to pay so little for something that I'm beginning to wonder if the quality of all of these or a lot of these portfolio management services isn't deteriorating as a result. I mean, like you mentioned, the risk profiling process in most of these robos is, I mean, I think it's almost dangerous. Yeah. I think that the one thing that a human advisor or at least someone with a lot of market knowledge does really well for people is profile a client really well. I mean, to me, portfolio management and financial advisory is a very, very customized and personalized experience where I have to know that person at a very personal level. I have to know, I mean, gosh, you could go through a questionnaire like that and one alternative question could blow that up. You ask them, how stable is your income? Yep. And if they say, it's pretty unstable. I'm in an industry that is very economically sensitive. And in years like 2008, I could lose my job in a heartbeat. That changes their whole profile.
Yep.
And if you don't know the person at that sort of a level and understand them for who they are at a very unique personalized level, you just cannot properly profile them. Yep. But what's happening with these robos is that they're implementing this very sort of cookie cutter profiling process where people are basically getting jammed into
a balance fund. He's getting a balance fund. That's all they're getting.
They're getting either a balance fund or I think in a lot of cases, they're getting something that is really unbalanced, a really stock heavy portfolio that is basically some derivative of your age and bonds or something like that, where I think a lot of these people, especially during weeks when the markets get volatile like they have been recently, a lot of these people are realizing what their risk tolerance really is, and they're going into these systems and they're probably changing the allocations, which is, you know, like I said before, if you don't understand your risk profile, if you don't get it right going in, the market will eventually teach you what your risk profile is. And you don't want that lesson to happen.
Yeah, that lesson is with a stick to the knuckles.
Exactly. You don't want to find out what your risk profile is after the markets fall, because then you shift out of stocks and you shift into bonds and it's the exact wrong timing and it's all the sort of behavioral flaws and biases
that the thing is, these robo portfolios have come about due to the fact of what we discussed when we started talking, was for the last couple of years, it's been boring out there. You know, and it looks easy. You know, you just invest in something and you don't require really any research and you just can put it there. Plus, you mentioned that you wonder if some of the advisory capability and the advisory process is being diminished due to the fact that there's low fees, or if the fact is that the diminishing advisory product has created low fees, however you want to look at it. The fact is that you get what you pay for, number one. But number two, the thing is that, you know, you're in a situation where, you know, they can't charge a lot of fees because they can't profile every person individually. Now, listen, we have different portfolios that we manage. One of them is our higher, quote unquote, higher minimum portfolio, where we spend time talking to clients. Okay, what is it that we're trying to do? What are your goals? And they change from time to time, of course. And you go through that and you set up portfolios based on that. Okay. And you can have many portfolios that look the same, but you may have some that are very customized as well. Then there's other portfolios that we have that are, hey, this is the portfolio we're running. It's an aggressive portfolio for a piece of your assets, you know, blah, blah, blah. The portfolio, the overview of the individual has to be, you got to be an aggressive investor and understand you could lose a lot of money at any given time, blah, 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 blah. Right. So, But the thing is that if you're trying to do a hybrid of that without any human interaction, because you do this all online, you fill out your own forms, the onboarding happens automatically, and the whole process happens basically automatically with a small team of people running all of this. I just scratch my head and wonder how this is going to really play out long term. And I guess this goes with the fact that people don't want to pay for websites either. Just want, advertising is fine. I'll just deal with it that way.
Yeah, I think that they're going to naturally really have to shift the model to some degree. I think that ultimately what a lot of these robos will change into is some sort of a hybrid model where they're providing for some people just this very basic cookie cutter style of passive indexing or something like that. But I think that more comprehensively, they're going to have to start layering in some sort of a human element, especially when you know how it works with a lot of high net worth people. I mean, these people have very complex financial lives that you can't just go into a computer system and, you know, answer a few questions and understand what's going on under the surface and properly manage all of that. You have to get really personal with a lot of these people. And that's naturally what happens is someone gets older. Their financial life gets more and more complex as they get older and they become wealthier and they're risk tolerance naturally changes and their tax situation usually becomes much more complex. And so I think that a lot of these businesses right now, they're kind of designed around gathering a lot of the, I think, small millennial type money type of accounts and people who think they probably have a really short or sorry, really long time horizon who can just sort of afford to be in a, you know, an 80-20 or 100% stock portfolio and just kind of ride it out. And as these people get older, they're going to realize, well, you know, these services not only maybe don't actually apply my risk tolerance correctly, but they're just not sophisticated enough to actually handle my actual financial life. And so I think you're going to start to see more of a probably a merging of the truly robotic side of things and more of a human element, more like what Vanguard is already kind of threaded the needle on this. They're already providing a 30 basis point robo portfolio with a access to human advisors as well. And I think that, I mean, Vanguard generally is kind of the pace setter in a lot of this stuff, and a lot of other firms are end up chasing what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we'll see. Cullen Roche, I appreciate your time. Lots more to talk about, but we've run out of time. So what we're going to do is put the links to your website and a few other things about you on the show notes from today's show. And we're going to definitely have you back. I appreciate all the wisdom you've shared. Appreciate it, buddy.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
I'll
appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye. Well, that was pretty good. I thought that was a pretty good interview. I thought it was really good, actually. Some things I talked about last week, I just want to bring back to the discussion here. I talked about Apple. There was some daily and weekly support on that. And I mentioned that there was some long-term support on the Hang Seng. Hopefully, you were able to kind of play that a little bit. FireEye, I mentioned, in the global security area, gold. Of course, oil stocks I had mentioned as being very concerning. I want to see what happens this week. You know, with the rise of oil by about 16% towards the end of the week last week, we did see many of the oil companies kick back a little bit. We saw a deal. Transocean was also a problem last week with cutting the dividend. But we did see that Cameron, CAM, was being bought up in that industry for a pretty decent premium. And we'll have to watch what happens with some of these smaller names that have actually already cut their dividend. Now, if they did cut their dividend because oil prices were coming in and now oil prices all of a sudden are on their way up, think about this for a second. Now they have this dividend cut that's already priced in and now oil starts moving higher. Investors will start thinking, wait a second, what happens if oil prices do go back up to 50, 55, 60? Will these companies reinstitute their dividend? In addition to that, if oil prices move up and these companies now have already cut their dividends, is that going to increase profitability? Right? So what happens is you get two benefits. One is the opportunity for the future of any of these companies that have already cut their dividends. Look at LINE as an example, and LNCO. Just as an example, not something I'm recommending or at all, but just look at these as examples of where that stock has gone, and especially after they cut their dividend. So you can track where they've gone when they've seen a dramatic move down in oil and cut their overall earnings potential dramatically. And then as they cut their dividend, people just ran out of these stocks and said, to hell with this. I'm not interested if they're not going to pay a decent dividend. But all of a sudden now, if you do see a turnaround in oil or at least a stabilization in oil, you have two things going for these stocks. The first thing is that potentially they'll increase their dividend or reinstate their dividend. And secondly, you'll have near-term benefit to their earnings because they don't have to pay out anything because they've already cut their dividends. So kind of an interesting little play there that you should probably keep an eye on. And then on top of that, you have many of the stocks that we've seen that really got wrecked in the technology area make a nice turnaround last week, and Apple being one of them. I think Apple hit down to 97 at one point. 97 on that major flash crash moment on Monday morning, and then came back up. We'll have to see what happens there, but there is some support on that. I did do a webinar online for TradeStation last week. You can probably just take a look at that over on Trigger Charts. We'll have that up this week, and we'll put some links on that as well, so you can take a look at what we were talking about with our aileron indicator, which is pretty cool. And I'll also mention that those oversold levels that we were seeing on Friday that I mentioned and into Monday and Tuesday were some of the lowest we've seen in a very long time. And I think that also was part of the reason that spurred many technical analysts into action to start buying stocks and support the markets moving into Wednesday and Thursday, Friday. And they saw that, wow, we don't usually see these kind of numbers. There's still a lot of work to be done to get markets not only back to where they were, obviously, but more so to create a much better sentiment. There has been an incredible amount of movement in terms of the VIX up to, I don't know, 52.5. And I think it settled down at about 26 on Friday. Short-term VIX instruments like the SVXY, which is short-term short VIX, or the longer-term VXX or UVXY. I've mentioned these. These are really playing very, very close to interim and very short-term movements of the markets. We did see these come down a bit or move higher, depending on which side of the trade they're playing. But still, you're talking about a 50% reduction down on the long-term core VIX index. And these have not played because there's still a lot of concern in the near term about short-term volatility. And just keep a watch on those, and something you may want to take a look at. Until next week, I appreciate you spending some time. And make sure to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com for all the information on this show and other shows, and iTunes, of course, if you want. Follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz, one word, is the Twitter handle. I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.